Hello, HAT readers. Welcome to the April 2024 Editor's Picks podcast. I'm your host, Roz Mannin, deputy editor from the University of Nebraska Medical Center in the Division of Nephrology. Today, I'm joined by two very special guests. The first is Dr. Laura Benari, assistant professor of medicine in the Division of Nephrology from Vanderbilt University and also our editorial board intern. So welcome, Laura.
Yes, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And then our second super special guest is Dr. Alan Kirk, professor and chair of surgery from Duke University Medical Center and the editor-in-chief emeritus of the American Journal of Transplant. And I believe on his watch had the podcast created. So welcome to you, Dr. Kirk.
Thanks very much, Roz. Laura, great to be here with you. And I'm excited to participate in something that I was involved in creating and never participated in.
And little did you know the popularity of this podcast. So let me give the listeners the content lineup. The first paper we'll be presenting is abdominal CT measurements of body composition and waitlist mortality in kidney transplant candidates by Dr. Quint and colleagues. The senior author is Dr. Mary McAdams-DeMarco. The authors are from Groningen, NYU, and Cornell, and that'll be presented by Dr. Benari. Next, we'll change the focus a little bit and talk about allocation in kidney transplant access. And that paper is A2, A2B to B deceased donor transplantation in the kidney allocation system error by Drs. Bisson and NYU colleagues. Senior author is Dr. Alan Massey. Then we'll delve deeply into the challenges of xenotransplantation and bringing it to the clinic. Dr. Kirk will discuss two viewpoints. The first is xenotransplantation experiments in brain-dead human subjects, a critical appraisal by Dr. David Cooper. And the second paper is the decedent model, a new paradigm of de-risking high-stakes clinical trials like xenotransplant by Drs. Montgomery and colleagues at NYU. And the last paper I'll talk about is exploring the single-cell immune landscape of renal allograft inflammation using imaging mass cytometry by Miriam Alexander and colleagues at the Mayo Clinic. So without further ado, Laura, I'll turn it over to you to tell us about CT measurements and waitlist mortality.
Yes, yeah, I'm happy to discuss this paper, as you said, by the Quint et al. And their group. And really the focus of the paper is using, you know, cross-sectional CT imaging and the assessment of body composition and how that impacts waitlist mortality for kidney transplant candidates. And I think for the background of this paper, you know, it came from that we already know that BMI or elevated BMI or obesity has been associated with delayed graft function, wound healing, readmissions, and decreased graft survival in our patients. And this has resulted in, you know, thresholds of specific BMIs to accept transplant candidates to be on the wait list. However, we recognize that BMI does have its limitations in terms of assessing for water, fluid overload, and what the muscle fat distribution is for the different, it can't really give a good detailed assessment of the patient's body composition. Whereas cross-sectional CT imaging has been shown to be a better way to get a detailed assessment of the muscle fat distribution to better assess patients' body composition. And some body compositions like myosteatosis, sarcopenia has been associated with some post-kidney transplant outcomes such as decreased function, graft, and patient survival. But what is unknown right now is how the different body compositions can impact waitlist mortality. And so that was the focus of this paper. And so what they ended up doing, it was a retrospective analysis that came out of Johns Hopkins Hospital. And they actually enrolled patients that were already part of a separate cohort study looking at frailty. So they identified about 830 kidney transplant candidates who had underwent non-contrasted CT scans for whatever clinical indication that was needed outside of the research setting. And then also the majority of these patients, about 730 of them, had undergone functional testing, I think, as part of this other study. And so that included a couple of different tests, but specifically did include grip strength, short physical performance battery testing, as well as looking at their physical frailty phenotype. So pretty rigorous, I'd say, assessment of their functional status and frailty that was done by research personnel. And they coupled that with the images from the L3 cross-sectional, L3 vertebra cross-sectional image on the non-contrasted CT scan. And so from the CT imaging, they could measure the skeletal muscle index and the mean muscle attenuation. In combining the CT imaging results with their functional status, they classified patients on the different body compositions as myopenia, myosteatosis, sarcopenia, and then based off of their BMI, they could be myopenic obesity or sarcopenic obesity. And then the primary outcome that they're looking at, of course, was the waitlist mortality for these patients. I'll let the listeners, you know, take a look at the paper to get more details about the statistical analysis. But do you want to point out they had two ways that they adjusted for confounders? The first for the, I guess, confounder analysis included age at evaluation, sex, dialysis type, and dialysis time. And they had additional fully adjusted model where they also adjusted for the cause of end-stage kidney disease. So for the overall results of the paper, they was a follow-up period of about 2.6 years. And during this time, 147 of the kidney transplant candidates did die while on the wait list. For the overall patient cohort, average age was 55, 39% were female, 42% were Black, 79% were on dialysis, but only a median time of 0.3 years at time of evaluation. People can take a look at table 1 and 2. That really describes more so the different patient characteristics for the separate subsets of the body composition. But the results that I will highlight will be, I think, coming from table 4. So when they were looking at the different body compositions and how that impacts waitlist mortality, both myopenia and sarcopenic obesity were not associated with increased risk of waitlist mortality. For myopenic obesity, there was an increased waitlist mortality, but only when they adjusted or stratified patients by age and frailty. So for young patients less than 65 who had myopenic obesity, there was an increased risk of waitlist mortality. And then for frail patients with myopenic obesity, also had an increased risk of waitlist mortality with subhazard adjusted ratios of about 2.2 and 2.5 respectively. When they're looking at the myosteatosis group, which had a prevalence of about 69% in this cohort, there was an increased risk of mortality when they adjusted for the other confounders. But when they did the full adjustment and included the cause for end-stage kidney disease, then that association was no longer significant. And for this group, For this group, the association with mortality on the waitlist did differ by age. So young patients of less than 65 with myosteatosis had the increased risk of mortality, whereas for older patients, there no longer was that association. And then for the sarcopenia category, which was about 25% of the patients, even with full adjustment of the confounders, there was an increased risk of waitlist mortality. And they did divide the patients based off of probable sarcopenia, confirmed, and severe sarcopenia, depending on their functional status and how they performed in some of the assessments. And I would highlight that for severe sarcopenia was the highest, you know, hazard ratio with a subhazard hazard ratio of 2.5. And the results or the association for this group did not differ by age or functional status. Some of the limitations of the paper that the authors do highlight, there was a chance of selection bias since they were only using patients who had undergone CT scans. And I think it's interesting to note that the patients that had undergone CT scans did have a shorter time on dialysis, about 0.3 years, I think, compared to about 0.5 years of the patients who didn't get CT scans. So that group was not included in this study. Also, since this was a retrospective study, the images may not have been optimal to appropriately measure the different components like skeletal muscle index. As they comment that some of the obese patients, the body habitus may have been out of the field of view for those assessments. So I think the overall, you know, takeaway from this paper really is just highlighting how complex it is to consider patients' BMI and body composition, how to get appropriate assessments of those, and clearly outlining that different body compositions have different impacts on our candidates for kidney transplant and following kidney transplant, and that likely the BMI is probably an inadequate assessment, I would say, to determine, you know, muscle quality and the body composition. Particularly, I think it's interesting that the myopenic obesity and sarcopenic obesity patients did have a different association with waitlist mortality, whereas the myopenic obesity patients who are young or frail had the increased risk of mortality, whereas sarcopenic obesity had no association with waitlist mortality. So I think just identifying how, if we need to incorporate this and how we evaluate our patients and ways to intervene on their different body compositions like myosteatosis, sarcopenia, and ways to improve their outcomes.
Well, thanks, Laura. I know that that was a lot of verbiage for many of us that don't study body composition, although we're always very careful about our BMI. So just for my own knowledge, this myosteatosis was found in about 2/3 of the patients. Do you have any sense in like normal health? Is this a relationship with their end-stage kidney disease, or is this a relationship just lack of body function or related to obesity in general? It's a term that I'm not familiar with. And so I didn't know, and that seemed to have a significant impact on outcome. Do you have any sense about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. And at least from knowledge and how the authors do comment on this, that we don't quite understand the mechanism of myosteatosis, I think, in our patient population, but it has been associated with chronic inflammation and insulin resistance. So kind of seeing that, it's not surprising, I think, to see that in our patient population, specifically with the prevalence of diabetics and the chronic inflammation that our dialysis patients are exposed to. But I think the mechanism isn't fully outlined. And I think they did highlight that the prevalence in this study, I think, was higher than maybe previously reported in some other patient groups.
And as you know, as we deal with allowing or making access to transplant more equitable, you know, many centers have set thresholds for obesity and BMI. And, you know, for those of us that are big, we're always fighting these things and saying, do they make sense? And so this paper does highlight that some of the body quality in it's not obesity in and of itself. But and again, this study, as you point out, these people were not imaged specifically for body content, but certainly it's not the word obesity itself. It's really sort of another, the sarcopenia or the myopenia that really has an impact. Alan, I see your mic is off and you may have a comment too.
Yeah, well, there's two really important points about this paper, I think. The first is that this may relate to allostatic load. You know, this patient population is one that endures an enormous amount of pro-inflammatory insults, not just dialysis. And this may be a mechanism or a measure of that allostatic load that is actionable. And the second point is then, can we take action? Can we intervene and try to reverse the impact of the pro-inflammatory insults that they're obtaining and perhaps reduce waitlist mortality through prehabilitation or other exercise programs or diets or things along those lines. But it's great to be looking, you know, more than skin deep on this and trying to figure out some underlying mechanisms for why people don't do so well. Some people don't do so well on the waiting list. It's extraordinarily important given the fact we don't have enough organs for it.
Right, right. Any final comment, Laura? Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, I think it also just kind of jumping off of that highlights the importance of or the benefit we could gain from incorporating, you know, functional status assessments for some of our patients, especially even considering it for our younger patients when we saw that association with, you know, less than 65 as well. But
absolutely, because those are the patients, you know, that we've focus a lot on. We say, oh, they're younger, they should do well. And I think there's a major underestimation of the quality of their actual health. And we do some frailty indices, which I think are more helpful if you look frail, if you're undernourished, if your albumin is low, you know, those kinds of things. So, well, great, Laura, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next paper, A2A2B to B deceased donation and kidney transplantation by Bisson and colleagues from NYU. So this is an SRTR study beginning December 2014, when the kidney allocation system CAS went into effect to specifically look at the access to transplant and outcomes using non-A1 kidneys for B recipients. So just as a background for some of the readers, because many may not remember most of these things because they happened 20 years ago, but in 2002, the OPTN actually had a voluntary variance that allowed the utilization of non-A1 kidneys, so-called A2 and A2B kidneys, to be preferentially offered to B recipients. And the goal of this was really Many of those B recipients were Black and or Hispanic ethnicity, and the goal was to try to increase equity to transplantation. And this was further expanded with CAS in 2014 because of multiple reports, including a couple from Vanderbilt, as I recall, from David Chaffer, about reasonable outcomes. And once patients consented to have this kind of incompatible transplant, quote unquote, and had available anti-A titers that were accepted by the center as acceptable, there was a dramatic increase in the utilization of these organs into the B population. There have been a number of single center assessments about the outcome. Of note, this group had actually evaluated the outcomes of A2B at a single center and noted that their outcomes were higher risk with a higher risk of death center graft loss of A2 to B. And this was in living donors specifically, not deceased donors. And so the question sort of remained lingering whether there was maybe something that was being unmeasured. And again, not having, you know, and having single center reports where there may be overly optimistic outcomes because the groups are really very skilled in that kind of transplant, they undertook this more global approach to understanding the impact of CAS and also the impact of these transplants across all transplant centers. So they evaluate data from, as I said, from 2014 to 2022. They identified individual candidates that were B that were ever listed as A2 eligible versus those that are not, and then compared the recipient outcomes. Recipients were A2 to B kidneys versus B or O into B, which they call B ABO compatible. Of note, they identified 53,000 B individuals that were candidates. During this period, only 13% of those individuals, about 6,700, were listed as eligible for A2 kidneys. They were less often white. They were less frequently female, but that was true whether they were eligible or not eligible. They clearly had less time on dialysis prior to registration. And then of individuals transplanted, they had almost 1,900 individuals in this time period that received an A2 kidney, compared to almost 11,500 that were B ABO compatible. They found no differences in race between those recipient groups, but there was shorter time on dialysis when they received an A2 kidney, and the CPRA greater than 80 was less frequent. There were a number of things that they looked at. I can't say much about the immunosuppression. It's really hard when you look at the induction versus maintenance. It didn't look like any major differences in those transplanted receiving an A2 kidney, but the number of transplants of A2 kidneys into B recipients increased by almost 30% over 7 years. Interestingly, in the meantime, the subtype typing for A1, A2 actually fell. In 2011, it was reported that 74% of centers of OPOs were typing donors as A1, A2, and that fell to about half in 2021. Overall, the transplant rate is much better and significantly better in A2 to B, about 31% in their first year of listing versus 14%, with an overall higher rate of deceased donor transplant of 133% compared to B or O and to B recipients. They identified comparable mortalities and death center graft losses, between the groups. I would say that they seem comparable to me. At least 1 in 5 years were very similar to general transplant populations. And interestingly, the estimated GFR, which has been discussed in the past, and trajectory was similar at 1 year, but had a slow but definite decline over 5 years. And they actually showed trajectories where the A2 to B was slightly lower, but not statistically significant. So overall, this paper assesses that there's no real apparent risk in death center graft failure, and an estimated GFR definitely, at least in the short term, for A2 to B, and certainly comparable to B and O kidneys and to B recipients, and clearly had a faster transplant rate. The questions do come up is why is only 13%, even in 2022, only 13% of B recipients deemed eligible, and why is this being underutilized? And I know some papers in the past by Paula Martins and Jamie Locke in 2018 reflected on this. Why are these volumes? They're going up, but they're not going up substantially. And the issues of the subtyping, which is definitely required, I believe, in AB transplant, and why this isn't being formed uniformly. You know, is the lack of eligibility clearly that individuals have high titer, and that titer is set at many centers 1 to 8, pick and choose your titer of safety? Is it because of the burden of repeated testing on the waiting list that's mandated by the OPTN? It's not clear. This paper does have limitations, of course, as an SRTR analysis can often do that. And obviously, the initial isohemagglutinin titers are not available, nor are post-transplant titers, although some would argue that the post-op titer really is not long-term predictive of outcome. Again, it's really hard to make any inferences about treatments that were provided to A2 to B because it's the SRTR doesn't really report on that. And again, the longer term outcomes of these individuals are not known, but at least the 5-year and potentially the 10-year mortalities and such seem reasonable. The trajectories are harder to predict because there's intervening issues that might lead to 10-year outcomes. So I don't know if you guys have any comments or thoughts. I know, Laura, your center has been one of the first centers that really reported a lot, although I know this goes back to like decades ago when Kansas was really doing this in the Kansas City OPO. All right. Anybody? Go ahead. Go ahead, Laura. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going to comment. Yeah, I think you highlighted some of the interesting things. I guess we just don't have the information on like you with the immunosuppression. And I'm not sure in terms of protocols that people use for their A2 to B kidneys. You know, I know we specifically will duplex IVIG rituximab depending on their titers, but I don't know how uniform that is across centers and if that plays a role at all in the outcomes, you know, for these larger studies. So,
I really actually thought that everybody was doing subtype analysis. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I thought that that was the case. But again, Alan, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I thought it was fairly common now. I was surprised.
Yeah, I was not surprised that it doubled in the period of study, but I was surprised that still 50% of centers aren't doing it. Yeah. And that doesn't seem to be in keeping with the data. I think this paper is an actionable paper that says that we should be doing this. If for no other reason, it gets people transplanted much, much faster. There's no doubt in the data that people get off the waiting list faster with this. I did see that there's a slight tendency of people to use depletional induction more so, and more people stay on steroids with this. And it would be interesting to know if that's data supported or if that's just bias. I think that it could go either way. And so another analysis that is ripe for the picking is to look at these institutional differences in level of immunosuppression, see if they're actually warranted.
And I know previously they had pointed to the number of women versus men, although here they seem comparable. The CPRA, I suspect that it is a bias. I suspect people think that these isohemagglutinins are circulating and we don't want to cause any disruption. And so we'll give them depletional therapy and then maintain them on corticosteroids as a safety. But again, it's hard to get super granular besides looking at the trends, but I agree with you. I was pretty surprised that so few programs do this, and it's not that difficult to do. Again, it may be a risk threshold issue as well.
Yeah, I'm also always been surprised at the actual outcomes with any transplant trial that tells us how far we have to go. The fact that this group does as well as the control group is great, but the fact that both of them have a 40% graft loss at 8 years,
I know,
is cautionary. I mean, we still have a long way to go with deceased donor transplantation in this country. And so there's still stuff to do here.
Well, it sounds like we'll still have a job in 10 years, Alan. So with that note, because we need more challenges, can you tell us a little bit about these two viewpoints on approaches to the clinical preclinical models for xenotransplantation?
Yeah, these two viewpoints come from two of the leading sites in the xenotransplant spectrum. And they're commenting on a fairly recent model system, which is called the decedent model system, where heart-beating cadavers, brain-dead donors that are unable to donate their organs for one reason or another, but still have their families' consent for participation in research, are used as recipients of xenotransplanted organs, uses organs from pigs to test in a setting where their resistance to rejection and the type of rejection can be analyzed without putting a live human at risk. And on the surface, this sounds like a really great idea, But I think these two viewpoints, which really come out to a point-counterpoint pair, show that there's a lot to be learned, but also a lot that can't be learned in these models. So the first viewpoint comes from David Cooper and Tateki Kobayashi, both leaders in the xenotransplant field. And they sort of take the anti-decedent model view. The main issue that they bring up in their viewpoint is that brain death is abnormal. And it's hard to say that just because the body looks like it's a human body, that it's behaving like a live human body. And it's well known that brain death evokes all sorts of dysregulatory, endocrine, and inflammatory problems that don't actually model what happens in live people. We've known that for a long time, just managing donors for donation. But trying to keep these donors functionally viable for many days is uncovering all sorts of problems that are perhaps give us inappropriate views of what a xenograft might do. They specifically examined four cases, two that were done at NYU and two that were done at University of Alabama, Birmingham. Both of these show very short-term experiments, just a few days long. Both of them show lots of inflammation in the kidneys. And it's very, very difficult to assess function in these studies because the recipient kidneys are left in place. And so how to understand whether the xenotransplant is contributing to clearance or not is quite difficult. There are certainly numerous limitations that are pointed out. They also point out that the FDA is asking for one-year survival of non-human primates with pig organs in place as a condition for moving forward with clinical trials. And they basically opine that there's really nothing that's going to be found in the decedent model that is going to counter what's going to be seen in a one-year study properly controlled with non-human primates. And that's really quite hard to argue. Non-human primate model is a strong model. However, there are some things that can be gained from this, not the least of which is the social consciousness that is achieved by doing these what would be considered staging xenografts. The success of xenotransplantation is going to require a lot of science, but it's also going to require a lot of social conditioning as well. And it will be very important to play to that social presence as much as it is to play to the FDA. And I think that perhaps the authors downplay that. They also point out that a lot of humans don't have antibodies to triple knockout pigs, where almost all non-human primates do. And that's another thing that might be an advantage of the decedent model that they acknowledge. Now, the next article is from Bob Montgomery and the group at NYU, which actually has done a couple of these decedent cases. And it starts with the premise that decades of non-human primate data have not accurately predicted the fate of the first two human xenotransplants, heart transplants that were performed at University of Maryland. And I actually take issue to this. First of all, there's only two transplants that have been done, so it's hard to develop trends. Or I guess if you can draw a line, you can develop a trend with 2 points, but not a convincing one. And I think if you're looking at the entire non-human primate literature, not just the literature that was from the University of Maryland, there are a range of survivals that have occurred that cross the span of what happened in these first two humans. So given the variability of the non-human primate experience, you really can't say that that experience has not been predictive. Indeed, the experience predicted that hyperacute rejection would not occur, and it didn't. It predicted that function could be maintained, and it was. And it predicted attenuated but not eliminated immune reactivity, particularly mediated by antibody and complement, and that was certainly seen. So I'd argue that the non-human primate literature has done a great job in setting the stage for xenotransplantation, but it hasn't shown everything. Now, one of the authors of this paper is Dory Zagev. He's one of the greatest statistical minds in transplantation. And I would I think he should demur a bit from trying to use the word prediction with an N of two. So we can think about that a little bit. So there are certainly potential advantages to the decedent model that are valid. But the bottom line is both non-human primate studies and decedent studies need to be interpreted in context. We don't need to create a false dichotomy here. There's things to learn in both, just so they're not overinterpreted. And I don't think you can get data in a non-human primate model that eliminates the possibility of successful xenotransplantation, nor can you do that in the decedent model. I think we can learn well from both, and there are limitations from both. The bottom line is that pigs aren't humans, and humans aren't monkeys, and monkeys aren't pigs. And if you pair them up differently, you're going to get different results. So I'm happy that this dialogue is being had. I think both of the authors and both of the papers raise good points, but neither of them eliminates the validity of either model.
So I think that's very well stated, having seen these both come through in press. I had heard at the Xeno meeting some very forceful comments by one of the groups, and then the other group comes up during the poster session and says, you know, this is what I meant to say. And I just, you know, thankfully, I'm not a Xeno person. I just get to listen and take notes. So I agree with you. I think they're a complementary, just like we do mouse stuff. People are getting all hot about, oh my God, the mouse model isn't the human. Well, we know that. We've known that for decades. Like, don't tell me anymore. But we learn things and then we apply them. And I certainly agree that who thought that there would be no antibody? I thought antibody rejection would still happen, but it would be attenuated. I think the unknown more in the Maryland case was the CMV transmission, which I was not expecting. And of course, had to read three papers and hear several news reports before that became obvious. But again, I agree with you. I think the science here really is complementary, and we try to keep moving this forward. And it's good to know about prediction with two, N equals two.
Yeah.
All right. Any final words about that before I move on to our last paper?
Well, the most important thing about these two papers and all of this experience is that the regulatory agencies don't make rash decisions based on single experiences, that we really need to interpret the entire literature to try to make progress. I think that's really important that point gets made.
I think totally. Thanks, Alan. That's a very good point, and hopefully that will come through. So I'll do the last paper, and I will not do this paper justice, but I will do my best. This is called Exploring the Single Cell Immune Landscape of Kidney Allograft Inflammation Using Imaging Mass Cytometry by Miriam Alexander at the Mayo. And again, this is a imaging paper utilizing some newer techniques. I want to say that, who's at UCLA? Juliet Amemioli has been doing this, I think, in some liver transplants, but it's the technique known as imaging mass cytometry, in which you take a panel of antibodies, you put it on the sections, and then you do all this high-level imaging and all these algorithms and analytical techniques to identify and localize cells in specific locations. And the goal of this paper was really to look at some specific immune clusters and spatial localization. I think initially the thought was enhancing the biopsy interpretation, but ultimately when you read the conclusion, it's really to stimulate the possibility of understanding mechanisms of both acute and long-term graft failure and injury. Just to summarize the methods for those of you that don't do this kind of work, and again, if I made errors, I apologize. They used formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue, which is sitting around your local pathologist. They used 28 markers for imaging that includes kidney structures like vimentin and alpha smooth muscle actin, and then a variety of immune cell markers, although interestingly, they did not use CD31, so they did not image arterioles. They imaged arteries, and they began with six clinical phenotypes, TCMR, both active and chronic ABMR, active ABMR that was active clinically, mixed rejection, BK, and chronic pyelo. And essentially, I'll summarize by saying that after they did the imaging, which utilized a CyTOF or time of flight mass cytometer connected to an imaging system, a Hyperion imaging system, they defined cell segmentation and developed an algorithm using a tool called star distance to identify nuclei so they could identify individual cells. They had cell classification using a set of specific thresholds based on staining intensity. They did single cell spatial feature augmentation with cell distancing analysis. So they were able to look at over 900,000 cells in their data set and their localization to the renal microstructure. They used renal structure segmentation or classification where pathologists annotated almost 3,200 different areas of glomeruli, tubules, interstitium, and arteries using a specific program called QPath. And then they developed cell clusters using a tool called Phenograph, and they ended up with 11 immune and non-immune clusters. Some of the key features here are they were able to do what's called a neighborhood analysis so they could co-localize the location of infiltrating cells and identify statistically significant interactions or lack of those interactions. So, for example, they noticed that there was a lot of inflammation in areas where there was increased expression of alpha SMA, which is an indicator of fibroblasts within the kidney. They also mentioned that VISTA, which is an immune checkpoint inhibitor, they noticed was near some epithelial-mesenchymal transformation clusters and suggested that maybe that is associated with a role in mitigating fibrosis. But again, with N equals a few of these biopsies, it's really hard to make any specific observations other than speculation. They integrated all of this imaging data with clinical data and said that they noticed that graft failure was associated with EMT and decreased of ATPase expressing tubules, which basically is language for that graft failure is associated with scarring and loss of tubular integrity. I'm not sure that's super new, but it's new using this technique. And then they correlated some of this imaging data with BAMP classification. I won't go in. They also do what's called the most valued features analysis, and they align these features with phenotype. And you can see that in I think, figure 3. Interestingly, there is some chronic pilo, looks like its own entity. There's overlap between BK and T-cell media rejection. I'm sorry to give that one away. Again, I'm not sure that's in some ways super surprising, but I think some of the key points here are this isn't a tool that your local pathologist will be engaging in anytime soon. This is really, right for now, a research tool that has opportunity to identify new mechanistic relationships. It does use FFPE tissue, so this is leftover remnant tissue. It doesn't require any kind of special manipulation. You can do simultaneous visualization of spatial relationships of immune subsets to structure. So it doesn't have to be kidney. Like I said, at UCLA, they do this relative to the liver. They use machine learning models that can expand this spatial data set and can identify specific biomarkers as they do more and more tissues. And it really allows you to interrogate immune cells in a specific regional pattern, as opposed to, say, flow cytometry, if you ground up a piece of kidney biopsy and then did flow, or if you did single cell RNA-seq, we've seen papers of that where you just pull all the cells out and do the RNA expression. And in fact, you can tandem this imaging analysis with single cell seq and try to do overlaps. Some of the limitations here with the sample size, you know, they use predefined biomarkers, so this isn't really a discovery necessarily. They had a priori hypotheses they wanted to test. There clearly was variation in the immunofluorescence staining that they used, and they noted that. And they really, fortunately, did not include CD31, so it's very hard. I'm not sure why they didn't. There's a lot of supplemental data and methods, but I think certainly for ABMR, when we're looking at peritubular capillaries and glomerular endothelium, it would have been nice to have that staining available. And again, I would emphasize that right now, this is not ready for prime time in terms of a diagnostic categorization. And if you want to hear the experts talk about this, please come to the BAMF meeting in Paris, because I know Dr. Alexander and her team will be discussing it along with several other groups.
So this definitely got the award for the prettiest pictures. And you know how surgeons like pictures. So I enjoyed this paper quite a bit. Figure 2 particularly was very lava lampy.
It's pretty wild. And then I was really more hung up on 3C because I was looking, you know, I was looking for patterns of these images and their relationship to the particular phenotypes. And so I had hoped to see things that were very distinguishing. And it looks like chronic pyelo is the most out there. And I think they just did that as sort of an inflammation control. But this ABMR plus category is active and chronic. And so I think some of the reason it looks different than the clinically active in the other column is that it includes, you know, glomerulopathy, and it may include really more fibrosis and scarring, which they didn't, you know, attempt to care. I mean, with such a small number of biopsies, they didn't care to, you know, they didn't align that and control for that.
Yeah. Well, one of the nicest things about it is these interaction networks that they're using, which are machine learning techniques designed to provide some explainability to the classifications. It's not just some black box classification. And there are some really neat preliminary observations that have dropped out. First of all, they really highlight the role of memory T cells in almost everything bad in the kidney, and that is a good target. The NK cell relationship and ABMR, very, very cool, definitely deserves to be followed up on. And the HLA-DR upregulation in the face of viral infection, also really cool. So this is, you know, small numbers, expensive technique, but really, really promising for future utility. I really liked it.
I liked it too. Well, with that, I think we've got our April podcast. So without further ado, I'm going to thank you both for joining us, and hope the readers look forward to our May podcast. And drumroll, the soon to return Josh Levitsky will be here, and we won't have as many guests. So I'll miss that because I've enjoyed having other people on this year quite a bit. Don't get me wrong about Josh, but it was just nice to meet other AEs and DEs along the way. Thank you guys so much.
It was great being here. Thanks so much.
The opinions of the hosts of the show do not necessarily reflect those of the American Journal of Transplantation. For AJT highlights, you can find us online at amjtransplant.com. That's amjtransplant.com. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter.